Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Today we welcome Gary Wayne to our show. He is a self-described Christian contrarian who has used his analytic and programmatic approach to piece together an overarching view of the events in the Bible. Gary is the author of the Genesis 6 conspiracy and utilizes a scholarly approach and offers up some possible explanations behind the origins of fairy tales and cryptid creatures like the Dogman and Sasquatch. In addition, the origins of the conspiracy have far more sinister implications. In this first of two parts, we examine the overall landscape of prehistory. Then we move to the flood, schools of knowledge, the splitting of bloodlines, dynasties, genetic manipulation, and more. Our approach to this subject is that it is yet another tool to apply to the expanding lens of how we view and understand the world and attempt to satisfy an insatiable appetite for curiosity. Okay, everyone. Today we are joined by Gary Wayne. He's well known in the alternate information side of things when it comes to biblical prophecy and the connections with his book called The Genesis 6 Conspiracy. Welcome to the show, Gary. How are you today?
Doing very well and so happy to be with you, and thank you for inviting me and hoping that, you know, we're going to get into a few things that your audience is going to find rather intriguing and maybe a little bit of an introductory into areas that they just may want to dig a little bit deeper into.
Yeah. And I think for me, one of the first times I heard you was on the Duke Sullivan's Bigfoot Radio, World Bigfoot Radio show. And you guys had a heavy focus on Bigfoot, monsters, kind of things that go bump in the night type of a thing. But you did such a great job kind of reaching out into that arc and applying a historical context there. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, that was fun. So I like getting into shows where you can connect a lot of dots. And in the genre of whether or not it's the monsters or it's the aliens or it's the giants or it's the little people, most people kind of have a gut feeling that there's maybe a connection there, but they haven't really seen kind of how that sort of comes together. And so in a lot of the research I do, I run across these things, and so I try and connect some dots to see, does that sort of fit my worldview in terms of how I understand things coming out of prehistory and what we're seeing today? And I find that generally there's those connections that are just sort of inexplicable, and they have a connection that's here today and a connection that goes back into history and into prehistory. So I find most of those things are related, and they're telling us of information and stories just sort of updated as how we view it today through the lens of technology and the things that we know. We may interpret that through that lens a little bit differently than some of our ancestors, but in types of events and the same types of beings.
I think that's fascinating because we do apply that lens of what we know, right? And I mean, we've had computers since I was born. There's been
marvelous advances in that, you know, my phone has the power of what used to fit in a room. But as far as our perceptions of things being shaped by that, it does play a role.
Yeah, I mean, people probably are familiar with something as simple as the idea that scientists are holding today that's called chimera or chimera effect, where they're blending the knowledge that we're gaining and manipulating DNA to create this chimera type of different being through that geneticism. And that's sort of the name that they like to apply for. What most people don't understand is that comes out of Greek mythology. And Greek mythology before what we would understand as the Great Flood, an event that's, again, recorded on all continents around the world, except for in Antarctica, and we'll see what is discovered down there. That's a different rabbit hole. And in all cultures. So it has like over 500 different original Aboriginal First Nations, so to speak, coming out of the flood of this event that's happening, something that was very, very real. And chimera is, you know, one of those things that is this absolute mongoloid creature. It's similar to a King Humbaba, or Humbaba, there's a B in there at the end, Humbaba, out of the cedar forest, that Gilgamesh and Enkidu, who are giants, are going to go kill. And so he's very similar in description to this chimera. And this Humbaba king of the cedar forest on Mount Hermon is the location where giants are created, probably both before the flood and after the flood, or at least that's where the oath was sworn to create those things. But this chimera, I'll just sort of kind of describe it if I can. And it was a fire-breathing animal that was part lion, and it had a goat's head, and it had a tail of a snake, and it created offspring as well. So there would have been more than one of them that were created. And there were offspring of Typhon and Echidna, which again sort of goes into these different types of creatures and into these gods that would create all of these, what I would call a greater Nephilim concept before the flood. And so there's a strong history around the world of creatures being created that are absolutely, seemingly, as people have sort of put it down in the modern times, of imagination, but yet they show up all around the world, which makes absolutely no sense if they were just out of the imaginations, because we're told that these civilizations didn't have that much contact. And when you're separated from oceans, then how do they come up with the same legends and the same stories? So it's inexplicable that way. So I think there is a consistency to what happened before the flood and maybe again after the flood. And what people don't really know is that these gods, which are the fallen angels, in from a Christian perspective, created these beings in polytheism, and they're just known as the gods. So that's the Hebrew word El, which means, you know, God Most High when it's capitalized, or it can mean an angel, or it can mean a god of the pantheon, or it can mean mighty, strong, and a mighty one. So it's got a few different meanings. So as it sort of comes out of the original language, you have to make sure the application is correct. But what we do understand is that these gods of the pantheon were the rebellious fallen angels. And so they make these creations as violations against the laws of creation, similar to what they've done with the giants that they create, as Genesis 6 talks about. And again, which is an event that's talked about all around the world in all cultures, with the same description of the same event, only seen through a parallel lens, or a polytheist lens versus a monotheist lens that we would look at it through the Bible.
Wow. You just covered a lot of ground. But I really do appreciate where you're coming from on that and how those connection points are made. For our listeners, our listening audience, and for people who are new to our show or new to your information, I'd like you to give kind of a 10,000 foot view of kind of what your work encompasses. What are some of the assertions that you make, and what are some of the assumptions that we might need to adopt to see that through that lens, if that makes sense.
Well, I think, you know, my research, it starts from a Christian contrarian perspective. In other words, I approach the Bible, and just as I did when I came back to God and Jesus and decided to read it as a contrarian would or as a Berean would. And I want to verify everything. And so I wanted to come at the Bible through an objective lens. And the more I read, the more intrigued I became with it, more interested, and that led me back to God and Jesus. So I look at the Bible not from what other people say it says. I look at it from what it actually says and how that connects throughout the Bible. And before I came back to become a Christian, I had a huge passion for mythology and history. And so when I decided to write the Genesis 6 conspiracy, and of course that's the verse in chapter 6, 1 through 4, where the giants are created, which is the preamble to the flood story, I wanted to, after I wrote sort of the first 10 chapters, I thought, you know what, I want to mix in some of my own knowledge of the consistency of this story that is held throughout the world. And so I started to put in various different legends from the mythology and then connecting that with some of the history and early prehistory that I would learn from history coming out and saw, you know, before those connections, but were able to set it not only alongside what Genesis talks about, but with what other cultures talk about and saw a consistent story. And so my view in terms of my research of what I do and what I continue to do is I decided to see whether or not I could link the events of prehistory to history and to what is going on today and what's going to happen in the end time. And I thought I was going to write a short book, but it turned out to be hopefully the largest book that I ever wrote. And it's packed with information. So there's no real loose sentences or paragraphs. It's 800 pages. There's over 120 pages of endnotes that show where my research comes from so people can verify it. And it is, like I say, it's just information after information after information and just trying to connect the dots. But showing the story of how things have a consistency of coming about before the flood, how that brought about the flood, how those races, peoples, organizations, and religions crossed the flood, then how they took over the same ruling class and organization with their organizational structures and religion as they did before the flood, because the giants usurped the kingship both before and after the flood, very early after the flood. And how that had continued throughout history with what we would know as the feudal system that was made up of all of these offspring of angels and human females that were known as demigods. And noting that demigod, in its ancient definition, was described as the offspring of a god and a human female that would produce heroes like Hercules or Atlas. Right. And again, you have Poseidon in the Greek, just to make a quick connection, you have Poseidon taking on Clymene. Of course, he had many other human consorts as well, but he created 10 demigod kings over the Atlantean Empire. And Atlas was his firstborn and the king of the capital. So Poseidon is doing the same thing as described by the sons of God, which are angels in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Who go to human females and create the giants, as the King James Version calls it, and other English translations will say Nephilim, which is the Hebrew word Nephil, from the root word fall, for the fallen ones who created them, and the I am is the male plural, and it's how you come up with that word Nephilim, if people have heard that one out there, and I'm sure they have, as it's more of a common term being used today. And it's the same type of being that was created again after the flood with the Rephaim. And so these are the post-Diluvian giants. And so that's the research that I'm doing. And I wanted to connect in the book and in my research, which I continually like to do, because I look at this as the Nephilim world order, both before and after the flood. And the NWO is probably the same Nephilim order that's going to be coming about. We just don't understand it in those terms as the descendants of those Nephilim and Rephaim, who are the royal class that imposed a feudal society of their relatives, of all of the nobility and the elite and the rich and all of the educated, controlling religion, government, and the army throughout history. And now they're going to try and recreate that new Atlantean empire in the end time with those 10 kings and create an age where they can consort with the gods again, just as they did before the flood. So again, I know that was a lot of information, but what the book does is connect all of those dots through sort of a 6,000 year connect the dots investigation into what I call the House of Dragons.
Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. I don't own your book yet, but that's something that I want to dive in both feet and examine those different data points and the connecting points, because that's how my brain works as well. Is like, oh, there's this piece of information over here. There's this too, and that kind of sounds a lot like this. So let's talk about it. I do want to kind of start. So in history, let's take it kind of back to the beginning. And you kind of, you start obviously with Adam and Eve in a garden, and it devolves from there into their offspring and offspring making decisions. And there's kind of a split that happens there. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So I think most people are familiar with the Adam and Eve story. And so they are deceived by an interesting individual, which is an Akash, which is the serpent. And I'll cover that as that being Satan, and I don't think it is. I think Satan is coaching or avataring the Akash, but the Akash is a beast of the field, and it's a walking, talking, intelligent being that is a serpentine being that is going to deceive Eve in the Garden of Eden. And so the serpent does deceive Eve, and that ostracizes Adam and Eve, and they now know the knowledge of good and evil, plus the knowledge that God taught Adam while in Eden, which would be substantial if you think about it, because he's running a massive agrarian society between four rivers that include like the Tigris and the Euphrates and two other ones. So it's a huge area growing crops, growing orchards. And we know there's orchards because there's the fruit of the trees that they're eating, and they're also raising animals, and we're told all about this in Genesis 2. So he learns a lot, and he would need to know a lot to be able to do that. And then this knowledge is going to be passed down through the generations, which is going to be a significant part on how the different genealogies split. So Cain, after killing Abel, is ostracized. And he goes east to the land of Nod, which is in Sumer or Shinar, as we would understand it biblically. And Shinar is a transliteration for Sumer, between the two rivers in Chaldea or Chaldea, however you want to pronounce that. And he takes a wife there, which is an interesting story. We're not going to jump into that right now, but he starts a bloodline. And you get that genealogy in Genesis 3, or in Genesis 4, I'm sorry. And you get that genealogy that has patriarchs right down to Lamech, who produces Jubal-Jubal, Naamah, and Tubal-Cain. And the names in that lineage are very much similar to the 10 that are shown in the Sethian line. And Seth is born when Adam is 130 years and sometime after Cain leaves. And so you get these two bloodlines. And polytheism and secret societies will connect their history and their beginnings back to the Cainite line. And so Enoch, son of Cain, and people should very much understand that there are now two Enochs, one that's the son of Jared in the Seth line, and Enoch, son of Cain, is going to develop this knowledge, put it into the seven sacred sciences, develop the sun-worshipping bull cult of the antediluvian epoch that crosses the flood at Nimrod, with Nimrod at Babel, but that's jumping ahead. And he's also going to create mystery schools to develop the seven sacred sciences that he has developed, this knowledge that was given to him from Cain, from Adam. And this is the knowledge that's going to blend with the illicit knowledge of the gods and or the fallen angels from a Christian perspective, that's going to accelerate the world and its technology to be able to create a lot of these maybe non-sexually derived, like a chimera type individual where it's got multiple types of animals involved, that knowledge will be developed at that level. And they're the ones who are going to partner with the fallen angels, with the daughters of Cain, to create these Nephilim, to create these demigods, to continue the ideology that's developed by the seven sacred sciences, as they call them. And those goals have been from the beginning and always will be, were to lead people away from God, the God of the Bible, to honor and worship the pantheon of gods, the rebellious fallen angels, and to not give God credit for anything, and to degrade God. Those are the four things they do, and they continue to do even to this day through control of the education, which I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail right now. We maybe will have time to do that later, how that comes about. But it's the same several seven liberal arts that we would know today. And so this is that organizational structure that is going to partner with those, the new bloodline, which is the offspring of the angels and the daughters of humans, or the daughters of Cain, which are the giants or the Nephilim. And they're going to dominate the world and parade it into the first apocalypse. So these are the bloodlines that are kind of discussed all around the world. We just know them by different terms. And then you get flood stories and you get different survival stories of humans and giants after the flood. But from before the flood, these are the bloodlines that are important to understand. And understand that there's a Lamech in the Sethian line and there's a Lamech in the Cainite line. And there's an Enoch that we talked about. And then if you look and you put them all side by side, which I do in one paragraph in my book, you see that the names are spelled very, very similar. And phonetically identical is just a little bit different spelling. So it's easy to conflate the two. But if you're going to understand prehistory and get into apocryphal books, understand there's two Enochs, and understand that both of them wrote scripture.
So that's actually...
one for a polytheist religion and one for monotheist religion.
That's actually a really good point. And I think that that's something that, I mean, until, gosh, last week, I was like, wait, there's two Enochs? Because it didn't make sense to me. I don't know if you've heard of some of the magic tradition that's come through the Cainite Enoch, but there's actually an Enochian language which people invoke in ritual and try to materialize things and try to manifest things, and that's a whole other thing.
Well, and in third Enoch, which is, you know, it's either completely corrupted by polytheism or it's written by Enoch, son of Cain. It talks about Enoch with the knowledge that he had and is also somebody who is equated with the god Thoth in Egypt and gods of wisdom around the Mediterranean, known by many different names. He has said in 3rd Enoch that he is elevated to angelic status to be a god through his knowledge, which again is all about the Gnostic and the knowledge cult in terms of how to become a god. One is you need this overwhelming knowledge is one of the key points. And in 3rd Enoch, he's described as actually becoming an angel or a god, as we would understand it in polytheism.
And his name is
called Metatron, which I forgot to put in there. So Metatron is seemingly spirit being that's guiding the high technology and quantum computing and a whole bunch of other different things that are going on out there, which is kind of an extraordinary coincidence if you weren't familiar with some of the things that maybe people should make themselves a little bit more familiar with as with respect to prehistory.
So it's important to understand the distinction, but also, if you hear someone that's saying that they're talking to Metatron, you might want to be cautious around that, right?
You would want to be very cautious. So whether or not it's actually Enoch, son of Cain, which is probably unlikely, it's probably a demon that is speaking, but using the name Metatron, I would look at Enoch as being human from a biblical perspective, but I'm open to the ideology that he may not be totally human. So from two points of view on that, and I talk about this in my book towards the end, not that I buy into the first part, but Satan is said to be the one who deceives Eve and Eden, but not to eat the apple, but to actually have sex and create Cain as the offspring. And that's a typical Gnostic doctrine. Or other angels rape Eve. I talk about those in the book as well. And that creates that serpent offspring that's talked about in Genesis 3:15, where the seed of the serpent will be at odds with the seed of Eve. And I don't think that that's the case, and I've got great documentation. There's a Christian out there. It's a four-part series to show why it's not the case, and I think the serpent seed is fulfilled in Genesis 6 as the offspring of the seraphim angels, which were fiery, serpent-faced watchers, dragons as we would understand them, with wings, with six wings as it's described in Isaiah 6. And so that's how you would get him as an offspring of Cain. Others would suggest that Cain married some other type of female angel and created Cain from that sort of offspring. And so there's a strong belief system that the lineage of Cain is part of the Sumerians' king list that people might be familiar with, or the Larsa king list that goes back to the beginning of the flood, to the flood and before, and with the kings after, and that researchers that I talk about will relate those various kings of Cain to being part of those kings before the flood, and that they were demigods or Nephilim or giants. So there's a strong sort of following on that whole lineage could be demigods, and therefore the Metatron could be a Nephilim evil spirit, right? That, and if people aren't familiar with where I go from being, let's say, Enoch to an evil spirit, understand that the Nephilim in First Enoch were given a counterfeit spirit from the fallen angel, and they became immortal. Now, God steps in Genesis 6:3, limits life to 120 years going forward, and the bodies of the giants are going to die because they don't have the ability to maintain the physical immortality. Their spirit is still immortal with what God has set place in Genesis 6:3, and they don't have access to what Adam and Eve did to the tree of life. So they don't have that access to them either. And so the bodies die. And the spirit is not permitted to go to sleep, and it's not permitted to go to heaven. And so that's the demons that I think Jesus is seeing in the New Testament, and I have a great document on that for people that walk you through it scripturally, and how we know the demons are the evil spirits that Jesus is talking about, and not the angelic spirits, because demon possession is something completely different than angels, or in Satan, let's say, with Judas, who enters into Judas to help betray Jesus, which is an avatar and an avatara, right? So the avatara is Judas, and that's a common doctrine in polytheism. So Vishnu would have been incarnated into Buddha, and he had something like 16 incarnations or something like that, or Shiva into Narasimha. Shiva's the destroyer god. So you get those connections in terms of the difference between an angelic spirit and a demonic spirit. And the demonic spirit is always looking for a place of rest. And it's out there to deceive humans as followers of their parents, fallen angels, the gods, even though they're no longer have a physical body.
Well, that seems to line up with a lot of what my understanding is. I do want to talk a little bit about how, okay, so you talked about how there was the different ages, you know, Adam, you know, it's how old was Adam? I think he was like 900 before he was buried, but that means that he would have in, he would have known 10 generations or 12 generations of his own offspring.
Yeah.
And how does that connect to, so basically, you know, Noah's father would have known Adam directly, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He would have known Adam, and even Noah, because he's born before Genesis 6-3, and you get the genealogies in Genesis 5. He lived 600 years before the flood. That's where your math adds up. And 350 years after the flood. So he lives to be 950 years old.
Yeah.
Not immortal. Because, again, the descendants of Seth through Adam, and Adam as well, did not have access to the tree of life that they, Adam and Eve, had in Eden.
So there's something to the life extension, but also, like you say, God limited the days. He limited the days down to a max of 120. And that's actually, we see that dip as far down as almost like a 35 to 50 year max in, during the Dark Ages, just because of conditions and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and so as you get the genealogies that come forward after the flood, you see that shortening that happens quite quickly after the three sons, and you get into the Shemite line, and you see those ages coming down, you know, by the time of Abraham, which is within, you know, 300 years of the flood, I mean, his lifespan is going to be just, you know, over 100 years, right? So,
In the traditional sense, we talk about how there is the flood and Noah building an ark and certain people being on that ark, Shem and Ham being, and one other brother. I can't remember the name. Is
Shavet.
Okay. So those three sons are there, but then you're also talking about a surviving of the other bloodline. And I want to talk about how that is possible.
Well, there's not that many ways to have that happen. You've got kind of like three buckets, right, of terms of how it could happen. Is somehow on the ark. Somehow there's a stowaway, like the Gnostics will say, and as witnessed in the last Noah movie where you have Tubal Cain, or in other versions, it's Og hanging on to the edge as a stowaway to survive. Or somehow that the sons, or one son in particular, Ham, in other versions, if all the sons are giants that are, you know, not all the true offspring of Noah, or that Noah's a giant as well. So the Gnostics have a lot of different versions on that, but somehow on the ark. And there's a lot of Christians that follow that too and say, well, it came from the genes of the wives that created the giants. And so I'm going, well, that's fine, but that doesn't explain how the Rephaim came about. You get the genealogy coming out of Ham's descendants, but you don't get told how the Rephaim come up. And Rephaim show up in Genesis 14 in the War of Giants. And Rapha is the word and the root word, and the I am male plural, it's the root word that's used in the Old Testament for after the flood, except for three times. Twice in Numbers 13:33, where it's using Nephilim for the word giant, and it's referencing back to the giants of Genesis 6, as opposed to the Anakim that are actually being talked about in Genesis 13 when the spies go into the covenant land. And the Anakim in Deuteronomy 2 are said to be giants, and that goes back to Rephaim. So the Anakim are a branch of the Rephaim. Doesn't explain how they come about, and the Emim, and the Zamzuzim, and the Horim, and the Hivim, and the Avim, and the Zuzim, and on and on and on, and all of these giant tribes. Because all of the families that are coming down in the Table of Nations in Genesis 10 and 1 Chronicles, where it has the root patriarchs for all of the nations, they're all listed, except for, let's say, like Arba, who is the father or the patriarch of the Anak, the Anakim. And so one presumes maybe Rapha might be the patriarch for the Rephaim tribe, and or from a god that had of a similar name, not Raphael, because we, you know, we look at him as more as a good angel, but maybe a derivation of Raphael of some sort. And so you get these families that show up. And the Canaanite families don't have patriarchs, except for K-Night has Seth or Hef and Sidon, but the rest of them don't have a patriarch. They're probably started by Rephaim as the male patriarch. That's why they're not listed, just as Arba's not listed and Rapha's not listed. And so those would be hybrid human giants. So the Amorites, which would come from Amaru, which was a god, and probably a giant named after him that was Rephaim, that I won't go into the detail, but through the Amorites connected to Mount Hermon. And so you've got all of those tribes that are hybrids that are part of the report, Numbers 13 as well, that are described as the people taller, but not Sheshai, Talmai, and Ahiman, who are the Anakim kings. Okay, and Deuteronomy 1, 40 years later, verifies these details. So don't get confused with the evil report that's embellishing, but identifying the veracity of the giants in Genesis 6. And I know I'm down a rabbit hole, so I'm going to back out of that right now and get back to the question. But anyways, they show up after the flood. I don't buy into that because it doesn't, as I say, it doesn't, somehow on the ark, doesn't really properly line up with scripture or answer the questions of the creations of Rephaim races. And other giants like Lionmen and Tengu, and but that's another rabbit hole. The second bucket is rather interesting, and I'm open to it, but it's not my favorite position. But in the Epic of Gilgamesh, who is a giant that is 11 cubits tall, Gilgamesh, which is, depending on whether or not you're using a common cubit or a royal cubit, he'd be 16, just over 16 feet tall to just over 19 feet tall. He's a king, so I think he would use the royal cubit, the king of Uruk, so I think he would be 19 feet tall.
He is
two-thirds god and one-third human.
That's massive. Most people, when they think of a giant, they think maybe 10 feet tall.
Yeah, no, their giants were bigger than that. Before the flood, they were bigger than Gilgamesh, because Gilgamesh is created after the flood in what I call second incursion, which would be my more favorite position. And he's sixth generation. And if he's not, if people want to argue him as an antediluvian giant, fine, but then Enkidu is created to offset Gilgamesh afterwards and his evil rule. And he's two-thirds god and one-third human, and created from the gods and human females as well. And so Upnapishtim is the king of the flood story that comes in the latter part of the Epic of Gilgamesh in about tablets 10 and 11. And he is two-thirds god and one-third human. And the archetypical Nephilim of the antediluvian epoch and king of Uruk, as Gilgamesh will take over five generations later from that lineage. And his whole family are giants. So in there you've got a survival story of the giants on an ark. And so I'm open to that, because the Epic of Gilgamesh is, on the macro level, telling a similar story to the Noah story, but on the micro and the detail level, it's completely different. You've got a survival of humans and you've got a survival of giants, and you get these survival of giants on arcs all around the world. So without going to be too laborious on it, Deucalion and Pyrrha out of the Greek mythology are said to be the Greek Noah. And Deucalion is son of Prometheus, who's either a demigod or an angel, but either way, or both, but either way, Deucalion is a Nephilim. So that's a Nephilim survival story. And there's just sort of no getting around that. Those are heroes and titans. They're called both, just as the gods are also called titans. So that's also a term to try and keep straight. They can refer into history like the Nephilim of heaven, the Nephilim of earth, the Anunnaki of heaven, the Anunnaki of earth, the titans of heaven, the titans of earth. So understand, one is demigods and one is the real gods, and they use them interchangeably at times. But that's also why the Greek heroes are defined as heroes like Hercules and Atlas that we talked about previously. So you get these stories of giants surviving all around the world, including the Epic of Gilgamesh. And you also get that second incursion, and that's where I'm kind of to fall, although I'm open to giants having their own survival story with the help of the gods or the fallen angels. But second incursion, again, because Genesis 6, 1 through 4 also says when the sons of God went to these daughters, and then again afterwards. We just don't know when afterwards are. We know more after the first incursion before the flood, and then multiple times again afterwards to create the giants. But it probably also means after the flood, because you get these Rephaim, which are somehow distinct after the flood from Nephilim, because they're called differently, and probably not as big and not as powerful and a number of other things, but they're there after the flood. And that lines up better scripturally for me than survival. But I can make a case for survival as well. I just lean more heavily for second incursion after the flood. So what happened to the fallen angels and the gods before the flood for violating these laws of creation and causing the flood to come about because of their actions, they were locked into the abyss. So if you've got these fallen angels doing the same thing again after the flood, then they would have also created all of these other creatures after the flood, and those ones also went to the abyss, and they would have been again been replaced by angels that didn't violate the laws of creation, fallen angels to govern the council of gods, as Psalm 82 talks about, over the 70 nations, as Deuteronomy 32 talks about.
So let's talk a little bit about the genetics. So I think when I think about genetics today, they've got machines that can rapidly gene sequence. They've got the CRISPR technology. They can basically pick and choose attributes and cut out mutations. They've got the Human Genome Mapping Project powered by supercomputers, probably quantum computers now. And all of these are allowing a basic injection of based on intent, kind of input to output. Is it possible that this is something that is using new tech, but based on old tech?
Yeah, and I think what's happening now is what happened before the flood. And so there's nothing new that's under the sun, and what has happened is going to happen again. And one more connection in terms of how this happens, and I'll get into the detail of it, is that when Jesus in Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 17 and 21 talks about when he's going to come again in the end time, he uses two overarching signs after he gives all specific signs of the generation. And that generation first is the fig tree generation. So there's a generation when all that comes about. That's followed immediately by the days of Noah. Be like the days of Noah. That's more than just violence and not expecting the flood and godlessness. It's an overarching thing to learn about what happened before the flood. And it's the exact same word, even though the New Testament comes out of Greek and into English, and the Old Testament comes out of Hebrew and into English. But as is used crossing those languages and into English in 9:28 to 9:29, when it talks about how old Noah was, as the days of Noah were 600 years before and 350 years afterwards. And Jesus would be exacting in his word. So we need to understand what happened both before and immediately after in the days of Noah as to what happened. And of course, that's when the giants were created. And that's where this knowledge was developed. And the details of the flood says that the whole earth had become corrupt. Not just violent, the whole earth. That means everything that was in it. And that's the Hebrew word chakath, which has several meanings, but all sort of pointing in the same direction as decay, degrade, spoiled, ruined. The whole world was done to. So that's indicating that the genomes of plants, the DNA of animals, crazy creations that polytheism documents all around the world were part of that whole world being corrupted. And it also explains then why when God had Noah build the flood. And then when it was finished, and he had selected who was going to be on the flood in terms of the people, that they would be who he wanted to start the world afterward. Noah, his wife, three sons, their three wives. And he calls all of the animals that he wants there to the flood, I mean to the ark. And they don't go out and round it up. God actually calls. And I said, okay, well, that makes sense because it just makes it easier. Yes, but God knows which ones were not corrupted. And so when people look at the unicorn mythos, you have them dancing and playing playfully as the mythos goes, and they forget to go to the ark. They didn't go to the ark because that was a DNA manipulated being that was used for giant Nephilim kings to ride on into battle. And they were the perfect animal for battle because they had this, they were giant beings that would carry these giant beings and their weight and their size, and their horn could gore an elephant with one blow, the unicorn. So that's why it's not on the ark. Only pure representatives of a species to multiply after the flood were selected to go. And that sort of, in sort of a quick little story, talks about the level of the technology that they had before the flood, assisted by the gods, but utilized through the mystery schools and the mystical religions to develop that, so that the demigod kings and their organizational structure would have had, by implication, that ability to contribute to that corruption, and that what we're doing today is catching up to what they're doing, and we're not there yet because we're not in the end time yet. So that indicates, by implication, then, that they would have been further advanced. And what we're doing is creating those same types of violations and could actually create other kinds of Nephilim, perhaps, through that. Now, does that explain the different kinds of Nephilim that are told throughout the world, whether it's the Tengu, that are these bird-like warriors and priests that look like the Anunnaki depictions out of Sumeria, or the falcon god out of Egypt, which is Horus, and other ones? Does it explain the linemen of Moab and Gad, or the Urgulo or the Urmulo, two different types of beings that were warrior beings in Sumeria that maybe come from a god that looked like that, like Bast or Mahes or Sekhmet or Nergal, lots of different lion gods? And does it also explain maybe Anubis and his creation of demigods, which he was a jackal god or a dog god with a dog man mythos? And again, I've got documents on all of that for people if they want to get hold of me. I can provide that for you. That's not in the book because the book is too large and I had to sort of weed things down. But all I'm saying is that were these lower classifications of warrior beasts, was that now the creation of science and technology? And or was that just limited to the plant genome and other things? We don't know because we don't get a lot of detail out of prehistory, but we know the whole world was corrupt. And we know, at least by what I'm telling people today, that that technology was greater than what we have today. And I would put on the table as a witness to that Machu Picchu, the pyramids, all these underground cities around the world, and many, many more megaliths that we can't do today, loaded with sacred geometry, lined with astrological alignment, done by a people who had no knowledge. Makes no sense.
Well, that's a fascinating connection point. There's so much there. There's so much there to jump off into. I think about the preservation or the care, like, so this cleansing, right? The flood, the whole purpose is to cleanse. And the fact that we don't have very much detail, well, that's probably on purpose. The other thing is that the continuation of these mystery schools, of these, of sacred knowledge, but then obviously is twisted to benefit those who have that corrupted line. And do we see a connection now, So I'm thinking here with Tubal-Cain being kind of the arbiter of that, and kind of what is the prefix of what does Tubal mean? And then also how does it apply to his curation of these mystery school knowledge, pieces of knowledge?
Well, of course, Cain goes back in part to the word smith, smithcraft. And so Tubal-Cain may be, as it's hyphenated on, may be more identifying some of the things that he did along with Tubal as being part of the name, because, you know, Tubal, Jabal are short four-letter names that were his siblings, right? Nama isn't that much longer. So that might be part of the case. But the big thing to remember, he's a huge, huge patriarch within the secret societies who come out of these mystery schools even before the flood and trace their creation to back then. And that's why Enoch, son of Cain, Lamech of the Cainite line, Nama, the four that are mentioned in the Bible are extraordinarily important to Freemasonry and the knowledge that they're said to have developed. And so they were believed in their history that they had a renaissance of this knowledge. And that's why they're part of the lineage that are provided for us in Genesis 4, so that we would know that. Nama was thought to be a cavorter and a wife of the gods, and then also of giants after that. So that's partly why some people think that she was put in, even though she is accredited with developing some sciences within Freemasonry. So yes, this is definitely connected to all of those patriarchs and the knowledge and the same organizations, as I said earlier, that are going across the flood. Now, Tubal-Cain is renowned and reveled as a master artificer of metals in polytheist and Freemasonry and Gnostic lore, known by a few different names in the Sumerian world, but a king nonetheless and a master of alchemy and metallurgy that rose to significant stature. So that's how he's connected into the polytheist side and why they like to have a way of showing him surviving, as what we saw in that last Noah movie.
So I want to get a little bit more into the secret society side of things and kind of project forward into what they're, so we could look at known history kind of during the current age, but also project into like, what role does it hold for future events?
Yeah. So let's first of all talk about how they crossed the flood, so that people understand the connections there and why that's important to understand. So we pick up the story right after the flood within the legends of Freemasonry out of the Polychronicon that they have. And they're all documented. So you get two pillars that are created before the flood. There's two legends, one of Lamech, one of Enoch. I think it better fits with the Lamech of the lineage of Cain, where they store, or it says in the legends, they stored the knowledge of the antediluvian world and the knowledge of the religion on these two pillars. They put some of that information on there, but it was more the directions as to where to find this knowledge. And so the children of Enoch recorded, the descendants of Enoch recorded all of this knowledge, although some legends say Enoch recorded all of the knowledge, into 36,525 books that are stored under the pyramids, to be held safely stacked on 9 vaults so that the flood wouldn't destroy all the antediluvian knowledge. This was found by a fellow that they call Hermes, which is part of the Hermes Trismegistus mythos of three different characters that's kind of blended into one, who finds this knowledge after the flood, or the pillars, finds the knowledge, takes it back to Nimrod. And with that knowledge, they build Babel City and Babel Tower, and we get a hint of that knowledge with God saying in the Bible that acting as one people with one language, anything they try and do won't be prevented them from them doing. So it starts to explain, at least from that parallel aspect, that that's where some of this knowledge comes from. And what's really interesting about that is also the mystical religion is part of that knowledge. And that's that Enochian, antediluvian mysticism, which now becomes the Babel or Babylon religion. That's the allegory for the end time. And Nimrod is this antichrist archetype figure over all of the people of Noah and his sons immediately after the flood. Within 100 years, has complete sway over everybody and is sort of the archetypical allegories we need to understand a lot of end time prophecy. And prehistory as a whole is helpful to understand the full meaning of what's going to happen in the end time and end time prophecy. And so the Masons, and understand the Freemasonry is a modern organization. The ancient organization was called Masonry and typically run by royal Masons, with the royal bloodlines running the upper ends of all of these Masonic organizations. And they still do today. But the first Grand Master of Freemasonry and Masonry after the flood is recognized in the craft as Nimrod, who writes the first constitution for the Masons. Now, it is updated at Heliopolis, the place where Moses is educated at before he converts back to monotheism and leads Israel to the promised land, where he doesn't quite get there, but almost there. So this is the organization and the religions that cross the flood that also match up with the giants again after the flood. And they set up the Nephilim world order that became the royal dynasties and the organizational structure of society even up to this day. These are the same royal families that are around today. These are the ones that keep their genealogies all the way back into prehistory. And all the bloodlines that are grafted in that come from other important bloodlines that would ennoble them, because the higher the purity of that bloodline, the higher level of scioning, grafting in of other noble bloodlines is where that family sits in the hierarchy and where that individual sits within the hierarchy of the Masonic orders of the royal bloodlines and through the organizational structure that rules the world. So this is the organization and system that comes down through us into our modern government. And just as an example of keeping track of those genealogies, Prince William and Queen Elizabeth claim descendancy from Vlad the Impaler.
Right.
Who is the model for Dracula, right? Who goes back to the Scythians and the giants that Japheth had married into, and that's why you have Gog and Magog is names that they're adapting as some of those offspring of Japheth, because they're going to intermarry with the giants after the flood. And Gog and Magog were the offspring of the god Iapetus. So that's where that comes from. And that's why you also have giants that have the same names that are in English prehistory as well, and are statues there to, you know, Gog and Magog protecting London even to this day. So that's kept well and alive. So these organizations have been passed down through the elite who've controlled religion and education and the nobility class all the way through. And they're the ones who want to establish the world that was before the flood again, so that they can mingle with the gods again. And they want to set up in the New Age, which is what Francis Bacon, who's a Rosicrucian, called the New Atlantis, with this universal religion and their bloodline kings in an organizational structure that would emulate the Atlantis of old. Atlantis of old was the most advanced civilization in Greek mythology, as Plato describes it, in particular with Critias and Timaeus. And there was those 10 kings of the empire. And it was a center for black magic and the mystical religions. And they were on a path through war to try and take over the whole world. But according to Plato, they were defeated by the Greeks, led by Zeus and his Nephilim, Hercules, Theseus, and that group against Poseidon and that empire. So there was many civilizations, understand, before the flood. And I won't get into how many at this point unless we want to come back to that. But this is that new Atlantis they're trying to set up again for the new Nephilim world order in the end time, from the descendants of these giants, and to bring the angels back out of the abyss, just as described in Revelation 9, and the angels that get cast down to the earth in Revelation 12, when there's the war in heaven, and that they want to set up their dragon Messiah, who is that offspring and of these bloodlines that will become Antichrist over the world. So that's sort of that quick connect the dots.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you'll join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.